And I was wondering how many would make it here today, so it's nice to see the rows pleasantly full. And hope all of you are in good health. It's good to see Rosie made it. We were wondering earlier in the week if she'd simply be put in a silent appearance here with us. Yes, I didn't know Fiona was coming. Yes. And thank you, Fiona, for rescuing Randall. We needed to have him rescued.
Come more often.
A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness. That's the opening of an epic poem by John Keats, one of the famous Regency poets of the English language. The poem is called Endymion. And I was introduced to it in my last year of high school. And it's one of the things that sort of sticks with me from those studies, because that was the time and the year in which I came to not only understand but find out about the amazing language and communication that only comes through poetry. Not that I hadn't been exposed to poetry before. I'd had to learn lots of poems, and of course every year in English at school you'd have a certain amount of poetry. But none of it really registered with me except in the sort of balladic sense. And I liked poems that rhymed, poems that told stories, and learned all the classic ones, the Banjo Pattersons, the Henry Lawson ones, and so forth. But it was a new dimension of poetry that I came across, not only through Keats, but through other poets at that time. We studied Milton's Paradise Lost, and that was an eye-opener to me, and I still go back to it from time to time and just revel in the language. And likewise, the Bible is full of poetry. And likewise, it takes a bit of getting onto, in the sense, because biblical poetry, whether it's the Greek or the Hebrew, is not the same as English poetry, even though it has that level of communication which transcends prose. And I think most of us know that, or would recognise, that the Psalms are one of the big repositories of biblical poetry. And not always do they connect with us. Looking at a psalm here that I've been looking at for the last several weeks, initially when I read it, not that I read it for the first time, but read it to look at it per se, it didn't really gel with me at all. But it turned out to be one of those ugly duckling type pieces. In other words, as you get to know it, as it grows before you, it transforms into something that is a majesty of beauty. If you turn with me to Psalm 123, this is the short psalm that I've been looking at. It's one of a series called The Songs of Ascents. And these were the words to hymns that the pilgrims coming to Jerusalem for the various festivals would sing as they proceeded in procession as they came together towards Jerusalem. Reading the New International Version here, it says, I lift up my eyes to you whose throne is in heaven, as the eyes of a slave look to the hand of their master. As the eyes of a maid look to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God till he shows us his mercy. Have mercy on us, O Lord, have mercy on us, For we have endured much contempt. We have endured much ridicule from the proud, much contempt from the arrogant. Now, when I first sort of looked at this and thought about it for a bit, a couple of things didn't gel with me. Why were these people, these pilgrims, going up to Jerusalem crying to God for mercy? It didn't seem to make sense in the whole context of the poem. A person crying for mercy is usually suffering under punishment or prospect of punishment in some way or another. And the other thing that didn't gel with me was the whole thing didn't seem to go anywhere. It didn't resolve. It sort of just ended. And those two questions made me look a little bit further. So I picked up the message to see if that would be any illumination. And Peterson puts it this way. He calls it a pilgrim song, which is adequate. And he says, I look to you, heaven-dwelling God, look up to you for help, like servants alert to their master's commands, like a maiden attending her lady. We're watching and waiting, holding our breath, awaiting your word of mercy. Mercy, Yahweh, mercy. We've been kicked around long enough, kicked in the teeth by complacent rich men, kicked when we're down by arrogant brutes. Unfortunately, that didn't help me at all. In fact, it made the situation worse. Even made the cry for mercy even more dramatic and even more urgent than it comes through in the other translations. It simply sounds like a cri de cœur, a cry from the heart. Now, when you look at the songs of ascents, you have to realize that they're not singular psalms. The whole of the series, which goes back to Psalm 120 and comes forward to about 137, are interconnected and they weave a story. So looking at one psalm, Psalm 123, without its connections, doesn't tell you a great deal. This one happens to connect back in with, well, let's look at the preceding psalm, Psalm 121. And you'll see resonances here on a theme. Psalm 121 begins, I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. And it goes on to talk about how the Lord watches over you. The Lord will keep you from all harm. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. And 122. I rejoice with those who said to me, let's go to the house of the Lord. Our feet are standing at your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem is built like a city that is closely compacted together. That's where the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord, to praise the name of the Lord according to the statute given to Israel and so on. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May there be peace within your walls. For the sake of my brothers and friends, I will say, peace be within you. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your prosperity. So those psalms to me make sense. They fit in with, you might say, the scene of Israel coming up for the festivals. So with Psalm 123, why would someone be so focused on someone who was so expressive in the opening verses of their dependence and their focus upon God? Why would they be crying out for mercy? So that made me dig a little deeper. And digging deeper, I went to the Bible dictionary and looked up the word mercy. And that told me the Hebrew word is hanan, which actually means favour, that is to show favour or to be gracious to. And it also pointed out that when the Greek translators came to translate the Old Testament in the time just before Christ, in the Septuagint translation, they did not use the Greek word for mercy, eleos, but in fact used the word charis, which should ring a bell for some of you at least. Charis is the Greek word for grace, which is very much featured in the epistles of Paul. So what they're asking here is for God to show his graciousness to them, to be kind, to show them favour, and in the context, in other words, to be or demonstrate that he is the kind of God that he is, caring and loving for his people. That still leaves the question, what about the second half that sort of doesn't seem to go anywhere or resolve itself? Hebrew poetry works on the meaning and the images thrown up by words, whereas English poetry tends to look for rhymes and metre. That's not so important, hardly ever occurs in Hebrew poetry. There is, one of the features of it is what we call rhyming of meaning, and a good example of that is verse 2, where you have the repetition here, as the eyes of the slaves look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maid look to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God. So you have the repetition of eyes and hand and so forth, and that visual connection of one to another, building up to the climax that comes in the last part of that verse. But the second half is different. And it features a construction which is very typical of many of the Psalms and of Hebrew poetry again. I liken it to a diptych. How many know what a diptych is? Oh, we've got a few artists in our midst. A diptych is usually two pictures which are on a theme or related to each other, that are joined together. Very popular in the Middle Ages, because quite often they would feature a picture on one side of the crucifixion and a picture on the other side of the resurrection. They'd be hinged together and close up like a book. And it was quite often taken from place to place to sort of set up for a service or to make a private shrine or something like that as an aid to worship. But you'd have two pictures which go together. Now, not always were they linked in the sense of being on a theme. Sometimes they would be contrasted with one another. And the idea actually emerges from the poetry of the Bible and poetry of Eastern literature, because this was a common thing. You'd have half the poem would be on one theme and half the poem would be on another theme, and there would be a link, sometimes obvious, sometimes not so obvious. The most famous example of that type of poetry is the 23rd Psalm, which starts off with "The Lord's my shepherd" and explores a shepherd-type picture for half of the psalm. The other half of the psalm switches to a picture of a banquet. My cup runneth over. The picture of this sort of royal banquet taking place. And the link between the two is quite often lost on us in our culture, because the word shepherd and the Old Testament, particularly in the time of David and afterwards, was always applied to kings, not to, as we tend to think of, ministers or priests or something like that. It was the king who was the shepherd of Israel. So when you said, when the psalmist says, "The Lord is my shepherd," he's saying, "The Lord is my king who cares for me." And that then fits in. That's the link behind the theme for the two halves. In this case, the link is the grace of God, because the break is between verse 2 and verse 3. We finish up with, "Till he shows us his mercy or his grace." And then the second half responds, "Show us your grace, O Lord. Show us your grace. Be gracious to us." But then the picture we have is, in fact, the opposite or the contrast to the first half. And you have spelled out in the verses a picture of people that are looking away from God, or looking through God as opposed to looking to God. It talks about contempt. It talks about scorn or ridicule. It talks about the proud. It talks about the arrogant. And sitting behind that in Hebrew thinking is the picture of a person's face, which tells you that they're proud or that they're arrogant, and the way their eyes look above or beyond or through someone without connecting with them. Have a look at Proverbs 21, verse 4. Proverbs 21. "Haughty eyes and a proud heart, the lamp of the wicked are sin." Haughty eyes and the proud heart. The two go hand in hand as far as Hebrew thinking is concerned. One other quick example, chapter 30 of Proverbs. Proverbs 30, verse 11. "There are those who curse their fathers and do not bless their mothers, those who are pure in their own eyes and yet are not cleansed of their filth, those whose eyes are so ever haughty, whose glances are so disdainful, those whose teeth are swords and those whose jaws are set with knives to devour the poor from the earth and the needy from among mankind." And when you understand that, you begin to see, suddenly you have these two pictures, one the positive and one the negative type of persons being the opposite of each other. So it says in verse 3 of coming back to Psalm 123, "We have endured much contempt." In other words, those who look or use their eyes to look down on us. "We have endured much ridicule or scorn from the proud. And the RSV has more accurately, "those who are at ease," or "those who couldn't care less." Much contempt comes back from the arrogant or the proud. And when you check behind the word that's translated proud or arrogant here, its root form means to rise, to be majestic. And what you actually have is the exact opposite to the opening of verse 1, which talks about the majesty, the on-highness of God himself. So what I originally thought was something which sort of didn't really round off and fit together turned out to be a beautifully crafted word picture of not just the way that God is, but the way that he lives and works with his people. It's a poem about looking to God, patiently waiting when the signs around us are anything but encouraging. So if you look in your announcement, order of service, on page 3, I've had printed in here for you the modern Jewish translation, which actually picks up these things more clearly than any other translation. It reads, "To you enthroned in heaven I turn my eyes, as the eyes of the slaves follow their master's hands, as the eyes of a slave girl follow the hand of her mistress, so our eyes are toward the Lord our God, awaiting his favour. Show us favour, O Lord, show us favour. We've had more than enough of contempt. Long enough have we endured the scorn of the complacent, the contempt of the haughty." A thing of beauty is indeed a joy forever. Its loveliness increases.